Great stock market crash arrived in October 1929. One of its incidental effects was to separate the men from the boys in show business. No longer could lavish productions be mounted on promissory notes and a handful of spangles. All those indecently rich friends of producers who nonchalantly poured their thousands into the musical theatre, in return for which privilege they might hope to get on grappling terms with a few of the chorus, they were wiped out. Their money overnight had gone through the window, and in some cases so did the men themselves, plummeting down to solvency from some 50th-story window, leaving the showmen to regret the passing of the good old days. To a man like Ferenc Ziegfeld, the Wall Street crash was a personal insult, because the stock market boom was one show into which Flo had put his own money for once. When the crisis was over, Flo was lighter by $2 million, and he never really picked himself up. The irony was that in 1928, the last of the bonanza years, he had been riding as high as ever. Showboat was still packing them in, and in another show, Eddie Cantor, playing the part of a hypochondriac who drifts into the Wild West, was giving him one of the great performances of the decade.
Another bride, another groom, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. The choir sings, here comes the bride, another victim is by her side. He's lost his reason, 'cause it's the season for making whoopee.
Concurrent with Whoopee was the Ziegfeld production of Showgirl, a comparative flop which is remembered today only for the Gershwin score, which included An American in Paris, the film of which won an Oscar years after Gershwin had died. The very notes of An American in Paris seem to speak across the great divide that separates the modern world from the old jazz age. As it happens, Showgirl was almost the last big Broadway show of that era. It opened in July 1929, but it wasn't quite the last. In the autumn, only a few weeks before the collapse of the almighty dollar, Ziegfeld imported an English show called Bittersweet. The leading lady was Evelyn Leigh, and her picture of Ziegfeld has a certain graphic precision about it that isn't always in evidence in the reminiscences of the people who remember him.
He always looked like an elephant to me. He had a rather a large hook nose, and when I first met him, anyway, he was dressed in grey. He liked dressing in grey. It suited his grey hair, actually. He was a man of great knowledge about women, in many ways, I should think. He certainly knew how to present a woman. I remember going to see one of his shows the first night that I arrived in New York, and all the girls looked so superbly groomed. Everyone was dressed according to their own personality. They were not all in the same colour. He had shown considerable taste in the way that he presented each one. Now, I remember at the dress rehearsal of Bittersweet, which I went over to do under his banner. He was doing it with Sir Charles B. Cochran. And he came into my dressing room and he said, you know, honey, I don't like that ball gown you wear. It's too fussy. It's got too much on it. Would you allow me to buy you a new one? And I said, well, yes, I would, Mr. Ziegfeld. I'm always willing to learn something, I thought. And he said, well, now, you must remember you've got a very small face. You can't afford to wear large patterns ever. And you can never wear a lot of things on your clothes. Be plain, dress plainly, because then your personality will come through. And I remember now thinking about that dress that he bought me. It didn't look anything else but a souffle. I've got a picture of it in my book that I wrote, and it's got a bustle just like a souffle. It looked absolutely wonderful. It was such a marvellous dress that when I made an appearance as a young girl, the dress got a round of applause. I don't think it was myself, it was the dress. Whether it was the fact that I changed from an old woman into a young girl, that might have had something to do with it, because in my experience, Americans are not very fond of elderly players in musicals. At least they weren't then.
It is like a bird on the wing. The
He was a curious man. He had an insight, really, into what Noel had written. And all he was thinking about was getting some girls into the show. And I don't think Noel and Mr. Ziegfeld saw eye to eye over this at all. In fact, I believe in the very end there was a contretemps of some description, and I think that is one of the reasons why it came off.
Hints that all was not well between Ziegfeld and Noel Card are substantiated by Randolph Carter, who explains it by saying that all was not well between Ziegfeld and most of the composers he employed.
Noel Card did not care for him. He had a great many friends, but he had quite as many enemies, and Noel Card was among them. So was Irving Berlin, in spite of the fact that they worked together. And as a matter of fact, Victor Herbert had his fatal heart attack after an interview with Ziegfeld.
Ah, sweet mystery of life, at last I found thee. Ah, I know at last the secret of it all. All the longing, seeking, striving, waiting, yearning, the burning hope, joy and idle tears that fall.
All is love and love alone the world is seeking. All is love and love alone that can remain. Till the answer is the end and all of living. For
after Victor Herbert found that The Sweet Mystery of Life consisted largely of chasing Ziegfeld for outstanding royalties and literally dying in the attempt, the legend grew that Flo was a bit of a Hitler when it came to the people who worked for him. As a matter of fact, that is exactly the definition that Randolph Carter falls back on.
He was quite a Hitler, and he insisted also that the songs be written immediately. I think the one who had the most stamina and could write the songs quickest for him was Irving Berlin. But even he had trouble. Ziegfeld had trouble with everyone.
And by everyone, Carter understands us to mean the ladies as well as the gentlemen. Perhaps we ought to retrace our steps, or rather Ziegfeld's, to see where he stood and who with after the 1929 crash. His marriage to Billy Burke survived several crises, including the highly scandalous infatuation with the singing star Marilyn Miller. Randolph Carter does mention the one woman in Flo Ziegfeld's life who was all sweetness and light, who loved him and inspired a love from him which apparently was quite unselfish.
After his death, he left some $1 million in debt, and Billy Burke paid a great deal of it back, did a lot of those films which she hated to support herself and her daughter Patricia, but he was not an easy man to deal with. He could be extremely cruel and very, very hard and very harsh. And Billy Burke did not have the happiest life with him.
Love me, only me. Let me be lonely. You won't believe me. And I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. You might find the nighttime the right time for kissing, but nighttime is my time for just reminiscing, regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else.
It seemed to me that the greatest love in Ziegfeld's life was his daughter. He was extremely gentle and kind to her, and she seemed to be the focal point of his life. She adores the memory of her father, and there are many lovely letters that she wrote to him.
He was very quiet, but he had a marvelous sense of humor. But Mother was so bubbly and all over the place and very active physically. He was much slower moving, and of course he was 18 years her senior. And I think he thought she was, you know, a little crazy, but at the same time, it kept him on his toes. He couldn't lapse back into any middle-aged slump of any kind. They were very good for each other. They complimented one another. He was easygoing, life was marvelous, and she was much more intense and inclined to be a worrier. He really didn't worry too much about anything. No matter what it was, he would have an optimistic outlook, whereas she tended to fret about things.
Well, it all sounds idyllic enough, but the testimony of a loving daughter is apt to be a little different from the recollections of the people who had to mix it with Flo professionally. Keenan Wynn heard from his father, Ed Wynn, what it was like being Flo Ziegfeld's production partner. The crazy thing was that once the Wall Street crash wiped him out, Flo picked himself up and continued to behave exactly as though nothing had happened. His first venture after the catastrophe of October 1929 was a play whose title sounds as though it was dedicated to the professional economists who had predicted that a Wall Street crash was impossible. It was called Simple Simon.
And in Simple Simon, my father had a drugstore scene. Mr. Ziegfeld at one point said, we have to have, like a toy department. So he said, we need some dolls there. He had a nasal voice. And my dad said, well, send to Macy's. He said, no. And he sent to Paris. Got like four dolls for $175 a piece. My dad said, Mr. Ziegfeld, that's ridiculous. You can't see it from the first row. He said, I can see it. And that's what he was like.
10 cents a dance. That's what they pay me. Gosh. How they weigh me down. 10 cents a dance. Pansies and rough guys. Tough guys who tear my gown. 7 to midnight. I hear drums loud. Saxophone blows. Trumpets are tearing my eardrums. Customers crush my toes. Sometimes I think I've found my hero. But it's a queer romance. All that you need is a ticket. Come on, big boy, 10 cents a dance. Fighters and sailors and bow-legged tailors can pay for their tickets and rent me. Butchers and bobbers and rats from the harbors are sweethearts my good luck has sent me. Though I've a chorus of elderly beaux, stockings are porous with holes at the toes. I'm here till closing time. Dance and be merry, it's only a dime. Sometimes I think I've found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All that you need is a ticket.
One of the things Ziegfeld couldn't see was a good song, and in Simple Simon he threw out some pretty choice items on the ground that they were pretty ugly items. In fact, he got so angry at the failure of Simple Simon that he refused to pay Rodgers and Hart, the songwriters, any of their royalties. Among the songs they wrote that Flo threw out was this one. Although he might as well have kept it in. I mean, when you're not paying for it anyway, what difference does it make?
He dances overhead, on the ceiling, near my bed, in my sight, through the night. I try to hide in vain, underneath my counterpane. It's not fair, but I'm so grateful to discover he's still there. I love my feeling more since it's in the dancing floor, just for my love.
As the 1930s opened and show business began to look uneasily over its shoulder at the octopus of Hollywood learning to sing and dance at last, Flo Ziegfeld embarked on yet another super extravaganza that was destined to become a super extravagant flop. It was called Smiles, and it was one of those shows where everyone hated everyone else and thoroughly enjoyed it. One member of the cast who never forgot the experience was Larry Adler.
Marilyn Miller and Fred and Adele Astaire were the stars. The salary list for the show was $43,000 a week. Now, no show could have broken even on a budget like that. It was absolutely impossible. It didn't deter Ziegfeld. The show turned out to be an unholy flop. It wasn't a very good show. In one number in that show, a Chinese number, had costumes for the showgirls that cost about £350 each costume. And he simply wouldn't stint. His slogan was glorifying the American girl, and brother, he really glorified them. To be a Ziegfeld showgirl was a passport to a career from then on. Just because you had been a Ziegfeld showgirl, you were famous and in demand from then on. Most Ziegfeld showgirls married millionaires.
Smiles was one of those all-star affairs that should have been wonderful and turned out to be one of the great disaster areas of Broadway history. The elements first began to come together when a lyricist called Harold Adamson met up with the composer.
It was the year 1930, and I was in Harvard doing the Hasty Pudding shows. And at this time, I met Vincent Humans, and I started writing with him while I was still in college. I did my first show with him, Smiles, which was produced by Ziegfeld.
What did a college boy make of the great Ziegfeld? The same, apparently, as everyone else.
Well, I thought that he was a rather flamboyant person. He lived on a grand scale and didn't pay his bills too promptly. But he was obviously a great showman.
But yet again, not always a great judge of a song. Looking back on it, connoisseurs of the popular song have no trouble at all picking out the one item in the show that had staying power. Harold Adamson describes it.
Well, the principal song that came out as a hit, strangely enough, became a hit in England before it became a hit in the United States, was Time on My Hands. It was nothing in the show and was almost thrown out. But Vincent Humans was very friendly with a famous singer that you may know called Marion Harris. And Marion Harris took it to London, and it became a sort of theme song for her. Whenever she was on a party, they say, "Sing Time on My Hands." So I was quite surprised in early 31 to find that it was already a hit in England.
Now, when Adamson says that Time on My Hands was nothing in the show and nearly got dropped, he leaves us wondering how and why. Larry Adler fills in the gaps and shows Ziegfeld in his spendthrift mood again.
We were in Boston. He wanted to get a message to me, so he sent me a telegram. At the time, I was in my dressing room and he was in the front of the house. He could have easily sent a messenger. No, he sent a telegram. And the telegram said, would I come out into the theater and speak to Mr. Ziegfeld? So I went out there. And he told me that Vincent Humans, who had composed the score, was unhappy because the ballad in the show was only used in the first act and it wasn't being repeated in the second act. Now, I had a solo in the second act, but it wasn't the ballad. And Ziegfeld said, would you mind switching your number? Instead of playing the one you're playing now, would you play this ballad? And then Vincent would be happy. So I said, well, Mr. Ziegfeld, you're the boss. If you want me to change, of course I have to change. But my number is doing very well, I said. In fact, it's stopping the show. And frankly, I think that ballad is a pretty dreary number. So he said, well, okay. He said, I just wanted to make Vincent happy. So I didn't change. I continued playing my number. And the one that I turned down was Time on My Hands, one of the great standards of all time. And to me, it was a pretty dreary number, so it shows you how much I know.
Time on my hands, you in my arms, nothing but love in view. Then if you fall, once and for all, I'll see my dreams come true. Moments to spare for someone you care for, one love affair or two.
Time on My Hands, beautiful song, though it undoubtedly was, didn't have enough beauty to save an all-time turkey like Smiles. The funny thing was that it was one of those catastrophes which everyone knew was going to be a catastrophe long before it opened, and yet everyone drifted towards the precipice as though in a trance. At one point, Larry Adler remembers, they called in the great humorous journalist Ring Lardner to help. But by then, what the show wanted was not a writer, but an underwriter.
It was quite evident that the show was going to be a flop. And, in fact, we had started without a complete script. Ziegfeld actually put the show into Boston without a finished book. So we never knew from one day to the next what was the ending of the show we were in. It changed every day. And they sent for Ring Lardner to do a rewrite job. And I was told this. I wasn't there at the time. But on about the third night, they were sitting up until 4 a.m. And finally, Ziegfeld says, for God's sake, if we don't lick this book, the whole show is going to be stolen by Larry Adler. And Lardner said that would be petty larceny.
You get the feeling from all this that under the circumstances, what a show like Smiles needed was a song about lunacy. And that, in fact, was what it got. The reminiscences today make amazing reading. Apparently Fred Astaire and his sister Adele, starring in their last flop together, were never on terms with the director or the writer, who was accused of wasting his time giving the chorus girls auditions at the back of the circle. And to make matters even better, the composer, Vincent Eumanns, often arrived for work a little bit the worse, owing to the fact that he'd apparently been suddenly taken drunk. It was a sort of poetic justice, then, that one of the show's best songs should be all about going crazy.
You're driving me crazy. What did I do? Oh, what did I do? My kiss for you make everything hazy. Cloud in the sky, all blue. How true were the friends who were near me to cheer me, believe me, they knew. But you were the kind who'd hurt me, desert me when I needed you. Yes, you, you're driving me crazy. What did I do? You. What did it, that, did it, that, do? What did it, that, do? Oh, Bim, you drive me crazy. What did it, that, did it, what, do? Oh, Bim, drive me crazy. What, do? What did it, that, do? What, dear? What, do, did it, what, did it, that, do? What, dear? What, did it, that, did, that, did it, that, did it, what, do? Oh, Bim, you drive me crazy. Bit, do, what, do? What, do? What, did it, that, did it, that, did it, that,
You're Driving Me Crazy, which you could take as the unofficial theme song of Smiles. Perhaps the greatest debacle in Ziegfeld's entire career as a Broadway showman. But how does a man like Ziegfeld react when things go as wrong as they did in Smiles? His behavior is an object lesson for those who would like to know how to meet adversity. The answer, apparently, is to blame the whole thing on other people. And when they come to you with the accounts, reply in an innocent voice, "Who, me?" The situation is described by Larry Adler, who clearly has a sort of grudging admiration for a man who could organize his fiascos on so massive a scale and could so cleverly snatch defeat from out of the very jaws of victory. Now, what about Smiles?
In this case, he was able to blame it on the writer, who hadn't come up with a complete script, and the director, who he fired and changed. Incidentally, he fired someone else in the show. There was a girl named Harriet Lake, And he didn't want to fire Harriet Lake. She was singing a number called Blue Bowery. But Marilyn Miller, who was the star and getting $5,000 a week, didn't like the fact that Miss Lake's number was quite a good number. And she insisted that Harriet Lake be fired. So Harriet Lake was fired, later on changed her name to Ann Southern and did very well. But when the show wasn't going well, Ziegfeld would go into rages and he would blame everybody, but never himself. He always felt that he was infallible, and if things did go wrong, it was because he was being sabotaged behind his back.
Well, when he was being sabotaged behind his back, did he cut his losses and run, or did he grind on towards the bankruptcy courts? Should a producer take off for Turkey, or does he owe a certain loyalty to the actors and actresses to give them a chance to salvage the ship? Apparently, Ziegfeld was as lavish here as in all other things.
I will say this for him. He kept Smiles running about 12 weeks. It should have gone off after the first week, because the writing was on the wall as early as Boston, when the critics panned the hell out of the show. And when we got to New York, we had one of the grandest diamond-studded openings you've ever seen. There were Rolls Royces and Daimlers and Bentleys in front of the Ziegfeld Theater, and every big name in the social and political and theatrical field came to that first night. Nevertheless, the show was a flop. And I think any other producer would have taken it off and cut his losses, but Ziegfeld kept it going for about 12 weeks. And remember, there was a salary list of $43,000 a week. And I don't think we ever took in $43,000 at the box office.
In another context, Larry Adler has suggested that perhaps in that 12 weeks, Smiles lost around $600,000. Oh, well, back to the drawing board. Undeterred by the disaster, Ziegfeld plowed on, and in 1931 put on the show that was destined to be the last ever edition of his famous Follies. Once again, the cast list was dazzling. Ruth Etting, Helen Morgan, and the great dancing team Buck and Bubbles. Also in the team was a songwriter called Ben Oakland, and he recalls with great clarity his introduction into the world of Ziegfeld.
Florence Ziegfeld was the very first man that I met as a child, literally. I had been invited to a party by Harry Richmond, who then was a very big star, singing star. Harry Richmond said, "Hey, Benji, play something of the new show for the gang." And that, the gang was people like B. Lilly, Tallulah Bankhead, Fanny Bryce, people like that. So I said, sure. This was about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I sat at the piano, and I thought I'd just play a few things from the new show. And by the time I had finished, I had played the entire show, and the audience were like just delightful children. They enjoyed what I had done. And I thought to myself, wow, this is great. And when I finished, Ziegfeld said, "What'd you do with this stuff? Have you sold it to anybody?" I says, "Yes." He said, "Who?" I said, "You." He said, "In my office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning." This was 4 o'clock in the morning then. I was there at 9, and he had his attorney out of bed drawing up the contract, and we signed the contract that morning to do the Ziegfeld Follies of 1931. He was a most unusual man, perforce of his greatness as an impresario, had the feeling that he didn't have to pay anybody. So consequently, he owed Gershwin, and he owed Kern, and he owed... he owed every writer that ever worked for him. I got paid not only every penny, but I had bonuses and gifts besides. Well, probably we did like each other very much as people, but he needed $50,000 more to complete his financing for the Follies of 31. And A.C. Blumenthal, who was William Fox's son-in-law at the time, and had just built the Roxy Theater in New York, also had lots of money, and he was also my personal manager. So I said, "Sweetie, you got faith in the show? Lend the guy the $50,000 and we'll get the show on." He loaned him the money. We all came out, as we say here in America, smelling like a rose. But on the other hand, one day I was in the outer office waiting for Ziegfeld to finish whoever he was talking with, and his secretary, Goldie, said, "Darling, he'll be through in 5 minutes. I said, "Fine." And a woman, a little old lady, turned to me, was sitting next to me, and she said, "Mister, do you know Mr. Ziegfeld?" I says, "Yes." She says, "I'm a seamstress. I have been working for 3 nights in a row. He owes me $32, and I haven't been able to get this money. I've been sitting here." Now, this was Ziegfeld. He smoked dollar cigars. He chewed black licorice candy that cost about 50 cents a piece. And he thought nothing about letting people waiting for money. He was the great Ziegfeld. Therefore, when I'm ready to pay you, you're paid. That was close, Ziegfeld.
The Ben Oakland songs for the 1931 Follies are forgotten now, and as a matter of fact, the entire score was relatively undistinguished. There was one Noel Coward item, which still gets a hearing now and then, but not even Noel was able to give the 1931 Follies any real distinction.
Laugh a bit, drink a bit, love a bit more. You can supply our need. Think a bit, chaff a bit, what's it all for? That's your Eurasian creed. Sailors with sentimental hearts who love and sail away when the dawn is gray. Look at you and say, half-caste woman, living a life apart, where did your story begin? Half-caste woman, have you a secret heart, waiting for someone to win? Were you born of some queer magic, in your shimmering gown? Is there something strange and tragic, deep, deep down? Half-caste woman, what are your slanting eyes hoping and waiting to see? Scanning the far horizon, wondering what the end will be.
That was one of the better songs Ziegfeld incorporated into the 1931 Follies, and it's an indication of how he was beginning to lose confidence as the sawdust of shows like Smiles began to run out of the sack, that in an attempt to regain the old glories, Ziegfeld propped up the 1931 Follies with ancient hits from the first triumphs of his career. In 1931, Broadway audiences heard this. That song had first been heard by Ziegfeld devotees back in the old days of Teddy Roosevelt and the New York of O. Henry. And in the early 1930s, those same devotees of Ziegfeld shows would have needed a well-lined wallet, as Ben Oakland describes.
In those days, tickets for a Ziegfeld Follies were so damn expensive, literally, that people didn't go unless they could very well afford it. Then that would mean going out for supper later, which was terribly expensive. Asparagus on toast, I remember. $1. Advertised, you know. So it was a rather an expensive evening going out to a Ziegfeld evening, shall we say. And Flo couldn't care less how long the show ran anyway, because the moment one show opened, he was planning the second. Until the 29 crash and money became nil, even the tycoons thought, well, we'd rather forego the pleasure of visiting backstage to say hello to our long-legged cuties than lose $50,000 or $100,000, whatever the amount was.
Well, what about those long-legged cuties? How did those legs actually move? Sometimes, of course, they weren't allowed to move at all except straight out of the stage door, as Larry Adler was describing earlier about Ann Southern. But provided the girls were allowed to stay indoors, this, according to Ben Oakland, is what it all looked like.
Well, I think the closest description would be things you might have seen in films where a youngster who has a great desire to become a star or a model is taken by a Svengali and said, "Here, young lady, put this book on your head and walk for 3 blocks and without dropping," you know, that type of a thing. He really trained them. And he had an eye. Incidentally, at the Ziegfeld Theater, he had an office, a private office, that he could open, slide a door open, and no one could see him. It was glass that he could look down on the stage, but you couldn't see the glass from the stage. And suddenly you'd hear a voice say, "You, fourth girl from the left, your seam is crooked." He was unbelievable, this man, when it came to girls. When it came to music, when it came to humor, he had absolutely no taste or no knowledge, I'll put it that way. He said, "Well, geez," and "I'm paying you, you ought to know, so I'll believe you."
The most pathetic thing of all about the last of the authentic Ziegfeld Follies, sadder than all the ill-advised sackings and the squabbles over money and the encyclopedic telegrams, were those old hit songs slipped in to kid people that nothing had changed. And in 1931, nobody was more delighted than two veteran songwriters called Monaco and McCarthy, because the song they'd written, back on the far side of the great abyss of the World War, suddenly became popular all over again in the Ziegfeld Follies.
"You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. You made me want to. And all the time you knew it. I guess you always knew it. You made me happy sometimes. You made me glad. But there were times, baby, you made me feel so bad. You made me cry for. I didn't want to tell you. I didn't want to tell you. I want some love. That's true. Yes, I do. Indeed, I do. You know I do. Gimme, 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 gimme what I cry for. You know you got the kind of kisses that I'd die for. You know you made me love you."
It was the last Follies that Ziegfeld had produced. The Schuberts, in latter years, went on and bought the title from the Ziegfeld estate. I think they did 3 other editions. And there's some very good songs, very good talent, but you know what it lacked? Mr. Ziegfeld. The class just was not there.
Next week, we'll take a detailed look at the Schuberts, the gentleman who took over the Follies from Flo Ziegfeld, but for the moment, there were still 1 or 2 shots left in the Ziegfeld locker. Now, people who were close to him noticed that the great Ziegfeld was becoming more and more eccentric in his day-to-day behavior. He used to sit up all night writing letters to the people in his shows, and the main trouble with that was that nobody could read them because the writing was illegible. He would refuse to change his shoes, wearing them till there were holes in the soles. He would refuse to pay the tiniest bills, even while he was pouring tens of thousands into his shows. He developed a phobia against red roses. In 1932, during the production of a more modest failure called Hotjar, Flo fell ill from violent stomach disorders, and after he recovered, he started worrying if his virility was fading. He was in his early 60s by now, but still he started taking hormones in an attempt to keep himself going, testing the effect of the treatment on the various chorus girls who had his best interests at heart. Flo Ziegfeld finally died on July 22, 1932. But not even the death and its welter of bankruptcy suits could quite put an end to his extraordinary career. At the time he died, his revival of Showboat was packing them in, and by now, so great was the strain on his financial resources that every week the Showboat cast never knew where its next wage packet was coming from, if indeed it came at all. 4 years after his death, his name still had enough drawing power to go up on the Broadway marquees, and the Ziegfeld Follies of 1936 is remembered to this day for one great song in particular.
I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted, but I can't get started with you. Around the golf course, I'm under par. And all the movies want me to star. I've got a house, a show place, but I can't get no place with you. You're so supreme. Lyrics I write of you scheme just for the sight of you dream. Both day and night of you, and what good do in 1929. I sold short in England. I'm presented at court, but you got me downhearted, 'cause I can't get started with you.
Some of the stars in the Ziegfeld Follies of 1936 were the same ones that Flo Ziegfeld had known, but there was one newcomer.
I didn't know anything about him except his reputation, you know. And he was also a very classy man. You know, all he thought about was getting the most beautiful girls in the world and the greatest talent. And how can you go wrong? And mounting it the right way. He had some fantastic shows, and of course the Ziegfeld Follies, and those days were something else.
That 1936 edition of the Follies, the posthumous one that Bob Hope was talking about, was also famous for a very sad reason, in that George Gershwin, who wrote the songs, died in mid-rehearsal. And in fact, the big hit, I Can't Get Started, had words by Ira Gershwin, melody by Vernon Duke, who stepped in to finish off Gershwin's score, and did his work most brilliantly. But Bob Hope represents the last of the long line of outstanding performers who are associated with the Ziegfeld Follies. Stars whose reputations have transcended their own time and have won them a kind of immortality.
I'll never forget the time I found a rattlesnake imprisoned under a rock. He was there begging for succor. That means help. So I freed him, and with a grateful look in his eyes, he followed me home. Before I went to sleep that night, I made him a bed of one of my old undershirts. Yes, it was the undershirt. I wear woolen underwear, you know.
Yeah, go on, Bill, go on.
Summer and winter.
Now, look, Bill, no one is interested in what you wear.
Well, that's funny. No man is interested in what another man wears. I had a blind dance.
What about the rattlesnake, Bill?
Don't be impatient. And as I bade the little rattlesnake goodnight, I patted him, her, it, on the head.
From W.C. Fields to Eddie Cantor was quite a distance for a man to travel, a man like Ziegfeld who never laughed at jokes, but somehow he did it.
Ah,
How you gonna keep them down on the farm after they've seen Harry? How you gonna keep them away from Broadway jazzing around, painting the town? How you gonna keep them away from harm? That's a mystery. Imagine Reuben when he meets his pa. He'll kiss his cheek and holler, ooh la la. How you gonna keep him down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
Or listen to this anecdote by Ben Oakland and then try to equate it with the stars who worked in the Ziegfeld shows.
Ziegfeld was very serious-minded. He never cracked a smile. There wasn't anything funny in life. He showed me a series of sketches with five mechanical elephants lumbering down from stage rear practically to the footlights with almost naked girls lying in the tusk while I had to invent elephant music. Now, when I finished, he says, is that elephant music? I said, no one else has written elephant music, so let's say it is. But the man had no, absolutely no sense of humor. I never saw him laugh.
What about the very specialized kind of elephant music that he hired another great comedian to create for him? Surely the stone face of Flo Ziegfeld cracked when faced with this sort of thing.
An introduction worthy of a Durante. Thank you. Seeking my favorite diversion last night and feeling in the pink, I steps into my plush upholstered Hansen. With my two footmen commanding the poop deck and my Arabian steeds going at a gentle trot, we approaches the theater marquee. And what happens? The red carpet is rolled out. My two footmen descend from the poop deck. They open the door and I steps out. Looking up from the gutter, I said, who told you to remove the running board? Picking myself up and ignoring the stares of the hoi polloi, I makes my entrance gallantly into the Diamond Horseshoe. I looks around. Mrs. Van Schuyler is whispering to Mrs. Murray Hill. Mrs. Murray Hill is whispering to Mrs. Susquehanna. And what are they saying? Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it Superman? No, they shouted, it's a bum. You see, a vicious rumor has been circulated just because I work in a saloon. They say I'm not fit to mingle in any other circle. That's ridiculous. Nightclubs is just a Mr. Hyde part of me. You have yet to meet the Dr. Jekyll. I'm Durante, the patron of the arts, an opera critic and a man of parts. Last week I went to the opera. I loved it. All but one scene. That's where the 350-pound soprano sings to the baritone. She sings, take me in your arms and hold me close. Why, to hold her close, the bum would have to be curved like a banana. Those opera lovers all rave at Handel's Largo. I've heard better music written by Umbriago. Now, what I say may sound absurd, but believe me, it's true. I've seen every opera, and I'll name them for you. Tales of the Vienna Rolls, Madame Buttermilk, and the Sextet from Lychee Nuts. I coach sopranos and tenors in their parts, 'cause I'm Durante, the patron of the arts. Now, just the other day, they held a meeting at the Metropolitan in the cellar. They said, Jimmy, we're in a hole. You gotta help us out. Stepping up on a soapbox left over from La Bohème, I said, gentlemen, let's analyze this. Now take Romeo and Juliet. Romeo has to leave Juliet. But does he say, shoo-shoo, baby? No, in opera he says, I have but a moment to spend with you. A moment, my dear, to spend with you. A moment to spend, a moment to spend, a moment, a moment, a moment, a moment, a moment. He's got one moment to spend and he's taken 3 hours to tell her. Why, the guy's making a federal case out of it. Facing the committee, I said, there's only one way to save the opera. Get yourself new lyrics that have style and renown. Like Pistol Packin' Mama, lay that pistol down. They all gave thanks from the bottom of their hearts to Durante, the patron of the arts.
The great Durante, another of the artists that Ziegfeld flung into his reviews and helped make legendary. Today we have nothing much left of Ziegfeld except the reputation for spendthrift recklessness, for lovely girls in and out of working hours, for spectacle and polysyllabic telegrams. Today, nobody is very scandalized anymore by the disruptive love affairs that Flo Ziegfeld drifted into and out of. Anna held in her bath of milk, Lillian Lorraine slowly drifting from self-indulgence to premature senility, Olive Thomas, who may or may not have killed herself as a young girl, but who may yet have outlived Flo Ziegfeld himself, Mrs. Ziegfeld, better known as Billy Burke, who worked to redeem his posthumous debts. And what of Flo Ziegfeld himself? The master showman who revealed so little of himself that posterity has scant first-hand evidence such as this fragment of the great man speaking.
This is my first appearance before a first-night audience of one of my shows. For more than 40 years that I've spent in the theater, I've let my boys and girls do the talking. But I couldn't resist the opportunity to speak to you, because I wish to thank you for what I trust is your gracious acceptance of the price of the Ziegfeld radio show.
The voice of the man whom P.G. Woodhouse said spent money he didn't have as though it was waste paper. The man who died in debt and whose most valuable asset, the title The Ziegfeld Follies, was taken over by a very different management indeed, the Schuberts. And yet, for all his deviousness and his welching on royalties, his dissolute behavior towards the girls of the chorus, Flo Ziegfeld, in a daft kind of way, has won. Nearly 50 years after his heyday, we still tend to think of him as synonymous with glamour on stage. In fact, it may be his greatest achievement of all that he very nearly succeeded in convincing a skeptical world of this much, much too optimistic theory.
And there, Michael Craig ends the story of Flo Ziegfeld, which was written by Benny Green, researched by Bill Sullivan, and produced by David Raven Allen.